As I said earlier, we're going to kick off a new series today, and it's unlike anything we've ever done before. It's called Real Issues, Real Voices. And for the next 6 weeks, we're going to explore some of the toughest issues that we're facing in our culture today, issues that are real, issues that are controversial, and issues that are quite political in nature as well. And now, I don't know about you, but when it comes to politics or political issues, I've gone through different phases in my life, and I just want to share those with you real quickly, because there's this one phase that I went through where I was really engaged. Like, it was the engaged phase. You know, I'm watching the news every night, and I'm, you know, reading different articles and reading different blogs and checking things out, and I'm up on all the latest debates, and I've got, you know, doing all my education to figure out what I should believe or what I should think about certain things. And you come away with strong opinions or strong positions on certain things, and you feel like if everyone just thought this way, and if everyone just voted this way, and if everyone just signed the same petitions I signed and all that, then everything would be all right. You go through those phases where you're really engaged. But then I went through a phase that I would say being exasperated, right? And feeling like being engaged didn't actually make a difference. Engaged just made me weary and tired, feeling like I was always on the losing side of the battle. Like, no one does see it the way I see it, and nobody is voting for the people that I'm voting for. And it just, instead of like being excited about winning victories in all of these issues, it feels like I'm just experiencing defeat in all of these issues, and that just leaves you feeling exasperated. But then there's a third phase that I've been through when it comes to political or social or controversial issues, and that's just simply being apathetic. Like, you get to that point where you realize, I just don't even care anymore, because I used to care, and where did that get me? Nowhere. And what changed? Nothing. And I don't even want to watch the news anymore. It just makes me depressed, and it's this side talking to this side, and nobody's actually listening to each other. And who has the time anyways to, like, be up on all the issues and understand everything about every issue and can actually form a well-informed opinion? And so you go through that phase where you just don't even care. You kind of check out. You're apathetic. Now, I've been through each of these things, and I feel like they're cyclical. Like, I go back through each of them maybe every 2 to 4 years, right? You know, and the reason I share that with you is because my hunch is you're like me, and you go through these phases as well. And my hunch is you're probably in one of these three phases right now. Some of you might be super engaged. Like, you love this stuff. You watch the news. You listen to news radio all day long. Like, you're into it. Some of you are probably exasperated. Like, you're just frustrated by the whole process and just tired, and you're exasperated. And some of you are probably just apathetic. Like, I don't care about this. Like, this doesn't make any difference in my actual life. And so why should I spend my time and mental energy even thinking about these kinds of issues? I'm guessing every single person in here could fit into one of those three categories, which makes it kind of dangerous, kind of crazy for us to think that we should talk about political issues, issues that are controversial and political in nature, for the next 6 weeks, because we have so much to lose. Because if you do care and you're really engaged, you're probably going to disagree with some things that are said by somebody about these issues. If you're exasperated, you're probably going to be like, oh, do we have to talk about this? And if you're apathetic, you're going to be like, oh, I'm going to check out for the next 6 weeks. I'll see you at the end of the summer, because there's a reason I don't watch the news. I don't care about this kind of stuff. On top of that, there's a huge danger in talking about these kind of issues in church, because you can easily swing from one side of the pendulum to another. There are two different extremes. I mean, we've all seen churches or church leaders become really political. So much so that you know exactly where they stand on every single issue, and you know what churches stand for, and even certain churches become known, like their identity becomes wrapped up in what positions they take on certain issues. And there's almost a sense that if I don't take that position, or I don't vote for the candidate that they don't explicitly say, but you kind of understand who I should vote for, if I don't think that or believe that, then I'm not even a Christian, right? But then the other danger is to swing the pendulum to the other side of the spectrum and to think, so we're just going to talk about Jesus we're never going to talk about these kind of issues because they're too controversial. It's just opening a can of worms. It's too dangerous. And we're just going to focus on Jesus and that's it. And, you know, we're not going to be one of those kind of churches. That's dangerous too. Because God, I think, cares about these issues. I mean, God cares about justice. God cares about life. God cares about race. God cares about the poor. God cares about the things that people are talking about in our society. And the truth is, people care about them. Like the people you work with, people you live near, the people that you go to school with, they're talking about these issues in our society right now. And if we can't enter into those dialogues, and if we can't somehow bring our faith into those and let our faith give us some perspective on these kind of issues, then what good is our faith? I mean, if we can't talk about issues like this at church in sort of a gracious way, well, then how can we talk about these issues anywhere else? And so we're going to try for the next few weeks to explore some really challenging, some really controversial, and yes, even political issues. And because these issues are so politicized and volatile and polarizing, here's what I want to do. I want to set the table today by outlining three ways that I hope we can engage some of these issues. We're not going to talk about all of them, but we've picked some issues, and some of you gave us some feedback on which issues you think are important to talk about. But I want to set the table by suggesting three ways that we can approach these issues together as Christians, as a church. So here they are, and I hope you'll write these down and remember them every week for the next 5 weeks. So, number one, let's think theologically instead of ideologically. Let's think theologically instead of ideologically. Now, let me unpack a couple of those words because they're important. Let me first give you a definition for what ideology is, because this is kind of a big kind of technical word. Ideology is simply a system of ideas and ideals, especially one that forms the basis of economic or political theory and policy. So it's a coherent system of not just ideas, but also ideals about how society and culture and humanity and people should be structured. And that often impacts the way we think governments and people in authority and institutions should enforce those ideas and ideals. And there's lots of different ideologies. Let me give you some examples. We put them on the screen. First, democracy. That's an idea and ideal. It's a political system that holds that the governance and authority of people, of a nation, is in the hands of the people in light of their freely elected representatives. And we all believe in this, right? I mean, most of us believe in this. Maybe there's some like anarchists or whatever out there. But most of us in our country believe in this. Like, it's not just a set of ideas. It's also ideals. We think it's the best system. So much so that we look at other countries around the world and we think, man, they don't have it as good as we do. They need democracy. They need to change. And we would love to export our ideas and ideals about how people should be governed, even to those. That's how much we believe in this ideology. Free market capitalism. I won't unpack that one. That's a big, long one. But it doesn't just impact sort of big picture policy things. I mean, it shapes the way we interact with everything in the world. It drives how we do business. It drives how we spend money. It drives every single advertisement we see on TV or on the internet. Most of the mail and emails you get are somehow driven by this idea and this ideology of free market capitalism. Here's another one, feminism. Some people would call themselves feminists. And so they would say they have certain ideas and ideals about equality for gender or for women in particular. And that drives the way they think about certain things in society. Now, we ideologies are not bad. There's nothing inherently bad about them. We all have different ideologies, and it colors and shapes the way we view the world outside. Now, there's two others I want to highlight, and these are more political ones. They would be the Republican / conservative ideology or the Democrat / liberal ideology. Now, I know those aren't the only two political options out there. There's lots of others, and it's a spectrum. And I know that Republican doesn't equal conservative and Democrat doesn't equal. I'm radically oversimplifying and characterizing. And yet we've got to acknowledge we live in a culture and a system that's dominated by two political parties and two sets of ideologies that help us understand how we approach certain issues. So much so that there's one ideology, a generally conservative ideology, and another ideology, a generally liberal ideology, that informs the way we think about every issue. You don't believe me? Think about this. When it comes to abortion, the liberal position is pro-choice, right? And the conservative position is pro. When it comes to taxes on the wealthy, who wants to raise them? Liberals or conservatives? Liberals, right. Somebody got the wrong answer over here. You need to watch the news more often. No. Who wants to cut taxes on the wealthy? Conservatives, right. Who loves the environment and hugs trees and wants to save salamanders? Liberals, right. Who loves the oil companies and big business? Conservatives, right. So, okay, generalizations, way over characterizing, but you get the idea, right? There's these two general philosophies and ideologies, and we've sort of embraced this idea that if you hold this general philosophy or ideology, it's going to inform the way you think about all of these different issues. And if you embrace this one over here, it's going to inform the way you think about all of these issues. Now, here's how I want to challenge us. If you're a Republican, awesome. If you're a Democrat, that's awesome. If you're a liberal or conservative, if you've got political convictions, that's great. Hold on to those. There's nothing wrong with that. But what if, for the next 5 weeks, we took whatever sort of political conventions or ideologies that we have, and we set them aside for a second, and we said, let's try to think about these issues theologically rather than ideologically. So here's a definition for theology. Theology is reflection on the nature of God, his creation, humanity, which was the pinnacle of that creation, and his intent for all things. That's theology. Reflection on the nature of God, creation, humanity, and God's intent for all things. And what you'll find is that when you think about issues through a theological lens instead of an ideological lens, you might think about them very differently and maybe even come to some very different answers when it comes to these issues. Because when you think about something theologically, you're asking the question, what's God's perspective on this? What does the Bible say about this? How did Jesus engage this issue in his day? And when you ask those kind of questions, it doesn't always line up with our ideologies and what they say. For example, was Jesus a conservative or a liberal? Yeah, yes. Good answer. Wow, I can get rid of that page. No, I mean, think about it for a second. I mean, sometimes you read stories and he was really conservative. Like, there's this one story, we're just going to get controversial right off the bat. There's this one story where some people came up to him and they asked Jesus about divorce and remarriage. And back in Jesus' day, there were two positions on this. There were the liberal rabbis that taught that a man could divorce his wife for any reason whatsoever. If she burned the toast, it literally says that in the rabbinical teachings. If she burned the toast, you could divorce her. That was the liberal teaching. And then there was the conservative rabbis that taught, no. There were certain reasons that you could divorce your wife, but they had to be serious reasons. And so these people come to Jesus one day and they ask him, so what do you think about this, Jesus? What are the reasons that people could a man could divorce his wife? And basically, in a sense, they're saying, are you a liberal? Are you going to follow the liberal rabbis? Or are you going to follow the conservative rabbis and say, no, there's only certain serious reasons for a man divorcing his wife? This is in Mark chapter 10. You can go read it yourself. I'm sort of paraphrasing. You know what Jesus says? He says, there is no good reason for a man to divorce his wife. That God's intent is that that would never happen. That's like, whoa. Jesus just like took the super conservative position. I mean, he went all the way to the right and then took another right. and basically said, like, there's no good reason whatsoever. Which is why his disciples left going, well, that's the case, I'm never getting married. Like it's just, we don't know what to do with that, Jesus. He's super conservative. But then there's other instances where it's like, Jesus is super liberal. I mean, one day, this woman is brought to him who is caught in the act of adultery. Like, she's caught in the very, like, there's no question about whether she did it or not. She's cheating on her husband. And there's this sense that it wasn't even a one-time thing. It wasn't like she made one mistake. It's a pattern. It's a habit. It is a lifestyle of promiscuity. And it's very clear what should be done with this woman. I mean, the Jewish laws are very clear about what the consequences are for this kind of lifestyle and this kind of pattern and the punishment that should be exacted. And so they bring her to Jesus. And what does Jesus do? This is in John chapter 8. What does he do? He doesn't punish her at all. He doesn't condemn her at all. He just lets her walk away. And there's a sense that the people are going, Jesus, do you understand how you just threatened the very institution of marriage? Like, do you understand that you just almost, it felt like you just threw away everything that our entire justice system is built on by just letting her walk away punished. How can you do that? It's like Jesus is like super liberal. And all throughout the Gospels you read and what you begin to see is that Jesus doesn't line up with any of our ideologies. He's not consistent. He doesn't fit into any of our packages or our categories or the way we think about things. Which means for us, if we're followers of Jesus, if we follow his teaching, and if we follow his example, then we probably sometimes need to let go of our ideologies and let go of our categories and follow his lead. And so the first thing that we need to do when we come to these issues for the next several weeks as we talk about them, I just want to challenge you, try to take your ideology, you've probably already got opinions on these issues, that's okay, there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe just try to take them and set them aside for a little while, and let's ask the question, what does God maybe think about this? Let me set aside my presuppositions and say, what does the Bible say? And there's not going to be any verses that say, well, here's what you need to think about this. There's going to be a lot of things we're going to have to look at. We'll have to think about the whole story of the Bible, how the whole story of the Bible leads to redemption and restoration. So how does a redemptive and restorative understanding of God and what the Bible says help us understand this very issue? And what would Jesus say about this? Because if Jesus is the most tangible expression and embodiment of God and who he was and what he stood for, then that should be pretty important in helping us understand how we should think about these issues. So that's the first thing we want to do. Here's number two. Number two. Let's feel with empathy instead of enmity. Let's feel with empathy instead of enmity. This is huge because the issues that we're going to look at and talk about are extremely personal. They're not just issues. They're not abstract. They're not philosophical debates. They're not out there somewhere. They're not just discussions about public policy. They involve real people with real stories and real lives. And one of the problems with the way we currently often talk about controversial issues is we talk about them in the abstract and we depersonalize them. And when we do that, you know what happens? We turn issues into battlegrounds and people into enemies. Let me give you an example of this. A couple of months ago, you remember when the law in Indiana was passed. There was this religious freedom law. If you're not familiar with it, there was this huge kind of debate about religious freedom, gay rights, and same-sex marriage. And there was this law that was passed, and a lot of things happened. It was this huge discussion. And in the middle of that, did you see this story about a pizza parlor? Did anyone see this story? There was this pizza parlor, and this woman, who was the owner of the pizza parlor, she was interviewed on the local TV station, which is always dangerous. You know, whenever the local TV station wants to interview you, just say no. And she said that her pizza parlor, if asked, would not cater a gay wedding because it conflicted with her Christian beliefs. Now, this is a bit absurd on a couple of levels. First, who asks a pizza parlor to cater their wedding? Like, it's just not even a realistic scenario, you know? It's never going to happen. So why are we even talking about it? Second, why would someone's Christian beliefs prevent them from serving someone else who maybe doesn't hold the same beliefs? I mean, isn't the heart of Christianity serving and loving other people that you maybe don't even agree with or don't act the same way or don't have the same behavior? I mean, didn't Jesus come to serve and save the lost? Didn't he heal sinners? Didn't he wash the disciples' feet, the very people who are about to betray him? Didn't he die on the cross for people and pray for their forgiveness while they're crucifying him? If that's not the heart of unconditional service and love towards people who maybe believe differently than you do, like, that seems to be the way of Jesus to me. Now, that's sort of beside the point. Here's what happened with the pizza parlor. It became a battleground almost instantly, because obviously her comments were inflammatory and it produced this firestorm. And so within hours, the restaurant's online site lit up with all of these terrible reviews that were pouring in all from across the nation. People giving the restaurant this terrible reviews, degrading insults, dehumanizing slurs, lewd pictures. And it's like all the hate and venom was directed at this little restaurant. And so she announced a couple of days later that because they had lost so much business and because so much had happened, they were going to have to close down. Well, then the other side mobilized. And suddenly an online site was set up, and 29,000 people from all across the country donated tons of money. They raised almost $1 million overnight to keep this pizza restaurant in business and to support the stance that she had taken. And you see what happened? Suddenly, this little pizza parlor that literally had nothing whatsoever to do with the issue at hand became a battleground. And both sides mobilized and turned each other into enemies. Both sides, who didn't even live there, who didn't even go to the pizza parlor to get pizza, and it had nothing to do with the issue at hand. All of a sudden, they become enemies, and they're fighting over this battleground. Here's what I want to suggest. The church should never become like this pizza parlor. We can never allow ourselves, our church, or the church in general, to become a place where battles are fought and enemies are to be defeated. And one of the most important ways that we can resist this sort of battleground mentality that it's us against them and there's the other side, whoever the other side is, one of the best ways I feel like we can do that is to try to nurture empathy instead of enmity. To ask the question in the middle of these tough and tricky and complex issues, who are the people actually engaged in these issues? Who are the people for whom these issues is personal? And maybe we should talk to them instead of about them, or instead of at them. What would it look like if we talked to people for whom these issues are personal and began to generate empathy, so that even as we ask the question, what does God say about this issue, and what does Jesus say, and what does the Bible say about this issue, what do the people for whom this issue is personal, what do they say, and what's their perspective, and what kind of voice can they lend to the conversation? That's why for the next few weeks, as we tackle some of these tough issues, we've actually invited a bunch of outsiders to come in and lend their voice to us as we think about these issues. So let me give you a preview of what we're going to do. Next week, on May the 31st, we're going to look at the issue of the death penalty with the outside voice of Dan Snyder. Dan's going to actually preach next week on this issue. And here's the deal. Dan has a degree in criminal justice. You may not know this, but before Dan became a pastor here, he was a police officer. And he was on the SWAT team. And he was dealing with hardcore criminal cases. And so he has this experience and this background and this perspective on this issue in light of his Christian faith that I think could help us begin to process this issue a little bit better. On June 7th, we're going to look at the issue of war and global conflict. And we'll be joined by a friend of mine named Ben Peters. If you were here last year, Ben joined us for the men's retreat. And he shared about his experience in the Marine Corps. Ben was a Marine, and he served in both Afghanistan and Iraq. He also went to seminary, and he wrote his master's thesis on how the Bible talks about war and global conflict theologically. So he's going to come and share a little bit of his perspective on that. On June 14th, we're going to look at the issue of marijuana. Rocky Mountain High, right? And we're going to be joined by a friend of mine named Chris Thurstone. Chris is a psychiatrist specializing in child addiction. He's the medical director of the Youth Substance Abuse Treatment Center at UC Denver. And he's a major in the U.S. Army working with soldiers who need mental health care. And he's currently working on several hugely funded studies about the impact of marijuana right here in Denver. I mean, he is an expert on this issue. And so he's going to help us process this and ask the question, how should we think about this kind of issue that's really important in our culture, in our city, in our state today? On June 21st, we'll talk about immigration. We'll be joined by Danny Carroll. He's a professor at Denver Seminary, and he's also half Guatemalan. He was raised in Guatemala, and so he's seen the immigration issue up front. He's a professor of the Old Testament, and he actually just wrote a book called Christians at the Border, Immigration, the Church, and the Bible. And so he's going to give us a little bit of his perspective on that. And then last, on June 28th, we'll be talking about LGBT questions. And we'll be joined by Elodie Emig, who's awesome. She's an instructor at Denver Seminary. She teaches biblical Greek there. I learned Greek from Elodie. And she's going to unpack some of the thorny passages in the New Testament that address this question and the question surrounding LGBT. It's a very thorny issue. There's a lot going on there. We won't be able to talk about all the issues. But what's awesome about Elodie is it's personal for her. She's not just a great biblical scholar. It's personal for her. She volunteers with an organization in Denver called Where Grace Abounds that focuses on creating a safe place for men and women to work out questions of sexuality and identity. And so she's going to come and share a little bit about that. Now, just because we have all these great people coming to help us explore these issues doesn't mean that they have all the right answers on them. It doesn't mean that at the end of every sermon or someone speaks, we're going to say, okay, and now here's the official New Denver Church position on this issue. We're definitely not going to do that. You might not agree with everything these people say. I might not agree with everything that they offer. But we think in light of their background, in light of their expertise, and in light of the fact that it's personal to them, that they have a voice that's worth listening to, a voice that's worth honoring and respecting, and at least considering how they can help us process these things theologically. So that's what we're going to do. Number three, here's the last way we're going to engage these issues. We need to embrace unity in the midst of diversity. Because you see, we all come to these kinds of issues with different perspectives, and my hunch is we're going to all leave with some different perspectives. And guess what? That's okay. Because none of these issues are central to our faith. They're important issues, yeah, but they're not central to what we believe about God and about Jesus and about salvation. One way we like to say this is we want to major on the majors here and minor on the minors, which doesn't mean these are minor issues. They're important, but it means that Christians can disagree on some of these issues and still agree on the main things. And truthfully, it's okay to disagree on issues like this. Paul actually had to deal with this in the early church. I want to read you a few verses this morning out of the book of Romans before we close. This is from Romans chapter 14. Look at what Paul says. Accept the one whose faith is weak without quarreling or over disputable matters. One person's faith allows them to eat anything, but another whose faith is weak eats only vegetables. He just said, if you're a vegetarian, that your faith is weak. Let me just say that. Paul liked a good burger. I'm just telling you. So let me read on, and then I'll tell you what's going on here. He goes on, he says, the one who eats everything must not treat with contempt the one who does not. And the one who does not eat everything must not judge the one who does. For God has accepted them. Now let me stop there for a second. Basically what's going on is there were these pagan rituals in Rome at the time. There were and animals would be sacrificed to the pagan gods. And then the meat from these animals would be slaughtered and they would be sold in the marketplace. And so some Christians felt like if they ate the meat that had been offered to these pagan gods, that somehow they were endorsing or agreeing with or approving of these pagan rituals. And they never knew which meat was part of it in the marketplace. And so they just decided, we're just going to be vegetarians. For moral reasons and moral convictions, we don't want to be a part of any of that. And Paul basically says, you know what? That's not a big issue for me. I know that, yes, some of that meat was offered to pagan gods, but I don't believe in those gods. Those gods don't even exist. And so I don't see how me eating this approves or endorses that at all. So I hold a different position, and this is a disputable matter. It's okay if some people hold this conviction and some people hold this conviction. Guess what? God accepts both. He goes on and he says this in the next few verses. One person considers one day more sacred than another, and another considers every day alike. So there were these debates about which holidays to celebrate and when to do the Sabbath and all that. Each of them should be fully convinced in their own mind. Whoever regards one day as special does so to the Lord. Whoever eats meat does so to the Lord, for they give thanks to God. And whoever abstains does so to the Lord and gives thanks to God. So the point is, when it comes to holidays, which ones to celebrate? When it comes to rituals, how exactly should we celebrate them? Even when it comes to some moral issues that some people, and eating meat sacrificed to idols was an intensely moral conviction for some people. Even when it comes to those things, guess what? The most important thing is you figure out what's true and right, and you come fully convinced of that, and then you live it out. And there's going to be diversity within the body of Christ when we all do that. And that's okay. There's going to be different views on what Paul calls disputable matters. And that's okay. And so for us, we have to keep that in mind. Because there's going to be different views maybe on some of these issues that we talk about. And these issues are important. But I think these issues fit within what Paul calls disputable matters. And there'll be diversity at the end of all of this, and that might even be good and healthy for us. I want to close by reading you something. I teach church history at Denver Seminary, and one of the great things about history is that it opens up people's eyes to how diverse the church actually is when you look back through the centuries. And at the end of every semester, I ask students to write a short paper outlining what they learned during the semester. And here's what I got from one student who turned in their paper. This was just last week. This is what the student wrote. Studying church history at seminary has forced me to accept that Christianity is much broader than my experience. It has caused me to interact with the diversity of the Christian community drastically different. Rather than hostility and a subdued arrogance, I have a greater desire to learn and understand. I also do not feel threatened by the difference, as I see there is often need for it. He goes on and says this, I now serve, and this is funny because I know the student and he's pretty conservative on that end of the spectrum. He says, I now serve at a church with female pastors who preach at times, a creation care ministry, and many staff that identify as Democrats. I would have laughed if I had read that last line a year ago. I began this job feeling very cautious. I had honestly not worked in ministry alongside individuals who would consider themselves progressives or liberals. What I have come to find is that this diversity can be powerful for the church to possess. Also, those who stand to my left are not heretics that need opposition. They are Christians with different passions that require my support. That's huge. I mean, he could have said, those that stand to my right, to my left, those that take different positions than me, they don't need my opposition. They're Christians with different passions that require my support. He goes on to finish by saying this. In short, I am far more willing and able to work with a variety of Christians, as well as learn from those I do not entirely agree with. Church history this semester has made this evident to me. I see how any hypothetical road that might exist to explain the history of the church, and I think he could have said the doctrine of the church, is much wider than I once believed. While there are still boundaries, they are not always as clear as I would wish. Neither is it always my burden to determine those lines. Perhaps even more important is that this diversity is not something to tolerate, but something to appreciate, as it reflects the grand and complex calling Christ has given his bride. What if we had that perspective? Or even if we have some different positions on disputable matters, we can come away and say, well, it's something that we need to divide over, and I don't agree with that person and all this. And it's not even something to say, well, I'm just going to tolerate it. But what if we could walk away and say, I can actually appreciate that. I don't agree. I come to a different position, but that's okay. I think our diversity might even make us stronger and more unified. Because if we can't practice grace and patience within the church, how could we ever practice it with those outside the church? So what if this series could help us do that? I'll admit, I'm a little scared to do this series. We could come away like, I can't believe this. But what if it really could? What if we could approach these things theologically instead of ideologically? What if we could begin to feel more empathy, or try to feel more empathy, rather than creating enmity and enemies? And what if we could embrace unity even in the midst of diversity? What if we could focus on the most important things, even if we have different positions on the disputable matters? What are the most important things? Well, that's how I want to close. For us, it's outlined in the Apostles' Creed. It's our statement of faith, and it's the oldest and most widely accepted and most foundational statement of faith for all Christians. It comes from the 3rd century. So what I want to do before we sing the final song and close out our worship service is I'd like to invite you to stand, and we're just going to say the Apostles' Creed together. So why don't you go ahead and stand? And we'll put it on the screen, and let's say this together.